Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. This is Boris Scarpa. Welcome to New Books and Military History. We have with us today a guest who is somewhat unusual for our show. We have Carlo Parisi, who is many things. He is a school teacher. He is a fencing master. He has been studying historic European martial arts for 20 years. He is a captain of the Italian HEMA team. He has competed on several international martial arts tournaments, and he also teaches historic European martial arts. And we are here to talk about his new book, his first book, Dagger Fencing, The Italian School. Carlo, I am very pleased to have you on our show.
Hi, Boris. Very pleased to be here.
You know, this show is we have certain traditions, and one of the things we always ask every author why did they choose to write this show, the whatever book, and in your case, of course, you are a very somewhat famous fencing teacher, and I've seen many of your YouTubes where you explain how to do different exercises. But you're mostly famous about what you have done with swords, with rapier, with sabers. So how have you come around to write a book about daggers?
I chose the subject, the dagger, because it wasn't a subject that had been studied in depth. And there were no sources available for the English-speaking public. At the time, most of what was available was about longsword, or, if we consider daggers, rondel daggers, the knightly rondel dagger, and also empty hand against dagger. There was no specific work on the cut and thrust dagger of the Renaissance time that could be applied with cinque dea, mano sinistra, the main gauche, stiletto, and the storta. So the various daggers that were worn daily in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance period. So I thought it would be interesting to fill this gap, also because this is a daily carry weapon of the time. So a lot of people had daggers on their belt. And a study on daggers and their use helps understanding the daily life of the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and even the Baroque period. So I decided to translate the sources, which thankfully were available either because they were online in PDF, but also because some researchers, especially the guys from the Achille Marozzo School, like Marco Ruboli, Luca Cesari, Jacopo Venni, had been working on the sources and published them in Italian, but they weren't available for the general public in English. So I isolated the Dagger parts, commented them, translated them, and interpreted them. Then I added my own drawings to help the reader understand what the techniques are about.
Well, this is some very insightful stuff you're telling us. And, you know, as you might have noticed from the title of the show, it says the new books in military history. It's not so much a martial arts show, it's a history show. So, I am a historian. My background is in 19th century history, and I also, of course, practice martial arts. I have done before different martial arts. I am now studying Hema. Although not dagger, mostly it is long sword and sword and buckler, which I study. But most people are not like me. Most people who are historians, you know, they will sit in their office, they will read books about these eras, they will go to the archive to work with the historical sources. So maybe you can tell people, what is the value to somebody who's studying history, who wants to learn about the past? Can you explain the value of studying historic European martial arts, other historic martial arts? What is the value to a historian of studying these things?
I think that the techniques applied in martial arts help understanding the context in which the techniques were used. If you consider dagger manuals, and fencing manuals in general, but I'm talking about daggers mainly in my book. So if you consider their use, you understand better the context of their use. If we start from the rondel dagger, you see that their use is mainly illustrated for the judicial duel, armored combat, or street self-defense. Why is it so? It is the area of application of these weapons in their time. The judicial duel was still a reality, and it remained in use up until the Council of Trent. Then you see an evolution in fencing, and you see an evolution in dagger fencing as well. Why? Because the Council of Trent reformed several aspects of life in the Catholic area. One of them is the judicial duel, which basically disappeared. So at this time, fencing focuses on the concept of life preservation rather than honor preservation and self-defense in general. You see a specifically defensive attitude, which is also usually explained in the preface of a manual, to better blend in with the moral and religious context of the time in which the manual was written and published. This is an aspect that is very evident. If you look into books' prefaces, you actually didn't want your book to end up in the list of forbidden books, which could easily happen with a book that deals with violence. And in my opinion, the Council of Trent is a turning point for fencing. And so you see through the techniques and their presentation, the evolution of the context, especially in the philosophical and moral sense. Now, the fencing master is a master of defense, and his purpose is to teach how to preserve one's life, not to teach you how to preserve your honor if challenged, because there is no more a legal framework for violence application in the civilian context. There is still the moral framework of war, but not a civilian framework, legally speaking, for violence. So violence can be justified only as a means to preserve one's life. And the fencing manuals reflect this. If you look at the dagger techniques that I illustrate in my book, basically all of them start with the defense. The good guy is never attacking first. So you are morally expected to fight to preserve your life and health. And this shows in the way fencing is taught.
Well, this allows me to talk about something which I think in our audience everybody knows, even if they are not in martial arts, since they are not military historians. Everybody has read Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, you know, it starts, there are these two groups of people, you know, these gangs of servants who are in the streets of Verona, yes? And of course, are you biting your thumb at me, one of them says, and of course they start to fight, yes?
Sorry?
If you remember Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet,
yeah,
the opening scene is a street fight. Yes, these two groups of people who are, you know, walking in the streets, and there are a minor insult, and they escalate very rapidly, and very soon the father of the family is asking, you know, bring me my longsword, and so really. Can you maybe tell us a little bit more about how interpersonal violence happened in Renaissance Italy, and you know in what roles these were daggers were used at the time?
Yes, the way I see it, there are several different contexts for street violence and dagger use in general. The first we have already mentioned is the judicial duel, which is a legal framework that is tied to the medieval mentality. The second is street crime, plain and simple. We see some very interesting examples of street violence in the life of Benvenuto Cellini. Messer Benvenuto describes some of his own crimes, the way he committed them, and his approach was very straightforward. When he felt he had to assault someone, he often preferred to draw his dagger, usually a storta, and assault fiercely his victim. And he has done it several times. He also includes a case of backstabbing. So crime was a reality in the street of the Renaissance Italy. And and basically, you had to be able to react to it. Also, we have a space in late medieval and Renaissance history for political assassination. There is a case that summarizes this practice, and it is the Congiura dei Pazzi, in which Giuliano and Lorenzo de' Medici were fiercely assaulted, and Giuliano lost his life, and Lorenzo almost lost his life. Unfortunately, at the time, violence was a political practice, and when you had a political opponent, killing him was a viable political option. Then we have war. And if we consider Italian history of the late Middle Ages and Renaissance period and the Baroque period, we see a whole series of long conflicts. First, we have a long conflict between Milan and Venice. This conflict lasts until the Peace of Lodi. At the time of the Peace of Lodi, a league of regional states was formed to maintain peace and balance. Lorenzo de' Medici was the architect of this balance and peace. Then, however, 40 years later, we see the beginning of a new long season of wars, which lasts from the Charles VIII of France expedition in 1494 up until the peace of Cateau-Cambrésis in 1559. During this period, we see a new type of warfare. The armies have changed. So if in the wars between the regional states, we see still the knightly model applied, the late medieval model applied with some innovations. These new seasons of war, this new season of wars, sorry, has some interesting new aspects, beginning with the role of the infantry, or the reborn infantries of Europe, and the great number of soldiers involved in the expeditions. And we see also the involvement of the modern state armies. So there is a new model of state and a new model of army in which the infantry has a new and important role, which shows again in the evolution of daggers with this new model. The focus goes from the rondel knightly dagger that was the main instrument of dagger fencing before, to the pugnale bolognese and the similar weapons, which are short swords, basically. Short cut and thrust swords, which are better suited to the necessity of the infantry, of the newborn infantry. Then we see again an evolution, because between the Peace of Cateau-Cambrésis to 1730, we have a new season. It's the season of the Spanish domination in Italy. In this time, fencing is more oriented, in my opinion, toward civilian self-defense and confrontation. It's the time of the rapier. It's a period of the rapier, of a street fight, because of course there is no judicial duel allowed, which doesn't mean though that dueling disappears. On the contrary, dueling becomes easier to organize. So it can happen on the spot, out of rage, out of a street altercation. And it's also a way to show one's courage, one's personal pride. So in this period of time, the swords evolve and the daggers evolve. The dagger used to be a backup weapon of the night. Then it became a daily carry weapon for the soldier, for the militia men, and also for the civilian. Now the dagger evolves and becomes a secondary weapon that is used often in conjunction with the sword. You would draw your dagger alone only if you don't have time to draw the sword as well, or if you are caught without the sword, or if you are lower class person and you don't own a sword. The dagger so becomes even more a form of short sword, and its method of use is again even more similar to that of the sword. The daggers acquire parrying ability because it is a specialized armorless street fighting tool now, because it has to blend into civilian life and civilian fights. So dagger evolution and the evolution of dagger methods reflects in a way daily life evolution, social violence evolution, and warfare evolution.
Well, because this is a military history channel, I need to ask a little bit. You said daggers were also used in war, and you know, when we talk about war in the Renaissance, we think, and of course in the Middle Ages, there are no guns yet, but at first there are, of course, pikes and other infantry weapons, and of course the knights have lances, and they have swords and horses, and later on guns also appear. So how does a dagger come in this sort of big fight?
The dagger is a backup weapon, which is very well suited to close combat. The pikeman, but also the knight, carry a dagger, because carrying one is not much effort, but it can come handy when the fight gets close. Also, the dagger can assist swordsmanship. Sword and dagger is a technique, a system of its own. You see the evolution from the armor-defeating dagger of the late Middle Ages to the sword-assisting dagger of the Renaissance, which can be used as a cut and thrust weapon in close combat or in its own right. And I'm talking about the Cinque Dea, the Storta, the Pugnale Bolognese. Then you see the main gauche for the rapier, the left-hand dagger for the rapier. Now you have a specialized instrument that is meant to parry, trap, and bind swords. Also, you see the birth of the stiletto. The stiletto is a weapon that is meant to be concealed, to be hidden. So it can be used in surprise attacks, or you can have it as a weapon in a context that is not permissive. That is not permissive when it comes to weapon carry. And so these are the main instruments: the Rondel Knightly Dagger, the Pugnale Bolognese, Cinque Dea, and Storta, which is a single-edged big knife that can have the size of a dagger. Then you have the main gauche and the stiletto, and all of them see application in warfare because they are common backup weapons that can be carried easily and used in close space. and also are very, very common in civilian life at that time, because not everybody could wear a sword, and not everywhere it was allowed to wear a sword. On the other hand, we must say that in some cities, it was a dagger was not allowed. I think Rome is an example. Rome was more permissive toward swords than toward daggers. But usually, dagger was a common tool, either in civilian life and in warfare, because it was the last resort weapon and the most useful in clothes. Its technique evolves to match the new context. So during its evolution, it goes from a thrusting weapon to be used against armor, to a cut and thrust weapon that can be used quickly against armorless opponents, but also against lightly armored opponents, to a specialized fencing tool that assists the sword, to a conciliable tool, the stiletto, that can be used unfortunately in acts of crime and political crime. So it blends in several ways, some of which are quite sinister. If we think about the 1500 political history, we see several cases in which, unfortunately, the short blades fits in. Not only Le Congiura dei Pazzi, but if I remember correctly, there are cases of dagger deployment even in French history, such as the Wars of the Three Heinrichs during the French Wars of Religion. Some of the disputes were settled by assassination. So the dagger could become a turning point tool for political life in the 1600, actually. So it fits in warfare, and also it fits in the political disputes.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, Carlo, I would like to ask a little bit, although, as I said, this is a history show, not very much a martial arts show, but I do have some martial arts training. I've even trained a tiny bit with a Rundel dagger, so I know it is nothing like modern knives. It is very different in the way it is used. It is very different in its shape. Can you maybe explain a little bit to those of our listeners who are not like you and me in military history, in martial arts, can you maybe explain what are the differences between the daggers, especially the Rundel dagger and the other ones which are in your book, and the knives which we see today?
Yes, the dagger is a specialized fighting instrument. It is not a tool. You can use it as a tool, but it is not its nature. So it was common at the time to have both a fighting dagger and a working knife. The dagger was not expected to be used as a tool. It is only a fighting tool, and either it is a specialized piercing weapon with limited cutting capacity, or if it is a cut and thrust weapon, often it has two edges. It is fast and handy, so it can be used to the best effect in fencing actions, and therefore its structure is not fit for hard work or the carving type. For that, you would want a working knife. But at the time, it wasn't a problem because people were usually carrying both, especially in outdoor life. They would use the dagger to defend themselves and the knife for daily tasks. The modern knife is, in my opinion, with exceptions, of course, a compromise. If we look at weapons such as the K-bar, they want to be both a weapon and a survival tool. Why is it so? Because in modern military life, the firearm is more important. So the blade has to be small and has to blend in with modern military life, and has to fulfill several tasks. In my own lifestyle, a dagger wouldn't fit in at all. If I actually need a blade, it's a bushcraft knife for woodworking and garden tasks. So the blade fits the context. If I was left with a single blade, my choice would actually be a bushcraft knife, not a dagger, not a military knife. So the modern knife is either a tool that can be used as a weapon, or if we are talking about street self-defense knives, which in my country actually cannot be carried at all, they are small weapons that can be concealed and are to be deployed in an emergency. But if we consider Italy, the knife is either a collector's item or an hunting tool, a tool used by the hunter, or a working tool. There is no legal use of the knife in the civilian life outside work. The knife has its place in the army, where it is a working tool and a defensive tool. This is my understanding of modern knife. I don't fancy myself an expert in modern knives, but this is my understanding of it. Now, the knife fits in the civilian life mainly for its working utility. I use knives daily in my home, but I use them to work wood or other materials.
And hopefully it stays this way for all of us. Nobody wants to be in a situation where they have to, you know, be in a violent encounter with someone. And I'd just like to add to what you've said, that the last dagger, which was, I still used militarily, is of course the Fairbairn Sykes dagger, which turned up during the Second World War. But of course it was still very, very small. It was so much. Yes, do go on.
The Fairbairn Sykes is, in my opinion, the exception because it is a specialized weapon.
And from this, I would like to ask, we talked a little bit about how the daggers themselves evolved, how the martial arts evolved, but also I would like you to tell us a little bit about how the teaching these arts evolved. How did a person who lived in Verona in the 15th century, somebody in the Renaissance era, how would they go about learning martial arts? How did this happen at the time?
So my understanding of the matter is this. At first, we see that the martial arts fit within inside the medieval structured society, which we call the società tripartita, the concept of ad alberone of Laon. So in the Middle Ages, society was divided in specific orders, and not everybody had the right to get martial training. Martial training was mainly for the knightly elite and for the soldiers who worked for the knightly elite, for the knights and the noblemen. It was a specific job to fight. Not everybody was involved. So it was, in my opinion, martial training was an elite matter at first. But then a social mobility happened during the late Middle Ages and the Renaissance. I think that the first who got access to martial training outside the elite were merchants. This is my understanding, because merchants would travel in dangerous places and could be attacked. So they became a social elite of their own. With time, and with the political evolution of the state in Europe, and with the advent of the civilian use of the blade, of the sword and the dagger, the fencing master had a broader audience, and the modern fencing school was born. However, fencing masters could still have another job. If we consider Marozzo, for example, he had a secondary job. If I understand it correctly, he was producing silk. And also Filippo Vadi had another job. But the job of the fencing master was becoming less elite-oriented and more mass-oriented, especially in the time of the judicial duel, when somebody could be challenged and had the necessity to learn fencing quickly. Later on, it became the job of a self-defense instructor in a context in which weapons had the lead over empty hands. So the sword and the dagger became self-defense instruments of life preservation. Then we see another evolution. The fencing school becomes the place for the teaching of a formalized way of fighting.
Just let me interrupt you for a second. Around which time do the fencing schools appear, the formal fencing schools?
It is my understanding that the period to be considered is the 1500, but we know that people like Marozzo, who had a fencing school, had been studying with other masters. So I wouldn't make a clear cut in this regard. But the 1500 sees the birth of the big fencing schools, in my opinion, and also due to the evolution and the diffusion of the press, the birth of the mass produced fencing manual, if you allow me to say something exaggerated, because of course fencing manual existed even before, but now they become a good that is available to a greater number of people. Fencing is available to a greater number of people, and a fencing manual is available to a greater number of people. We are no longer talking about manuscripts, but we are talking about books that can be printed in greater numbers. So there is a new fencing subject. And the fencing subject has good tools available to him from the foil, meant as a non-dangerous reproduction of a fighting sword, to the fencing manual, to the lessons of a fencing master. Then a newer revolution happened when the small sword and the fencing foil appeared. Now we have an even more formalized society, and fencing reflects this evolution, because fencing in the foil and small sword era becomes even more formalized. The rule set changes. So we have rules such as the ones we see applied in Olympian fencing today, and the practice of fencing is taught so that you respect certain rules of engagement. Then we see another evolution yet, which in my personal opinion is more related to the Congress of Vienna and the Restoration, what we call the Restaurazione. So in the 1800, because of the necessities of social order, because of the necessities to prevent new outbreaks of revolution after the French Revolution and the birth of the small Italian republics and the Italian kingdom, temporarily speaking, of course, because of these necessities, and because of the new role of the middle class and the desire to set aside the symbols of power of the older nobility, the weapons that were commonly, openly carried gradually disappear from sight. Now we see the birth of the knife schools, the regional knives schools, and the birth of the stick fencing school. The walking stick becomes a self-defense weapon used by the gentleman instead of the sword, because the sword was not socially accepted anymore, in my opinion, especially in the Italian area that was mainly controlled by Austria. There were specific laws restricting the possession and carrying of bladed weapons. So the gentleman would use the stick, whereas in the 1800s, the knife culture spread. New fencing schools were born. Of course, they weren't official fencing schools that taught the use of the knife with regional preferences. So we see the Pugliese school, we see the Sicilian school, we see the Calabrese school, the Naples school. The 19th century saw the birth of a new way of fencing with a shorter weapon, but also saw the birth of the stick, the walking stick fencing style, which is mainly based on the saber.
Well, from this we can move on to something which, just briefly, because time is an issue here, just briefly, I would like you to touch on, can you tell us, we started with this, and I'd like to circle back a little bit. Can you tell us about how people study these historical techniques today, how today the study is used to learn more about the past?
Okay, so in my opinion, there are three main tools that we can use today to reconstruct historical martial arts. The first is modern sport fencing, especially if you consider the technique and manuals up until the 50s and 60s, because those methods were still meant for duel as well as competition. The core of the techniques is basically the same. The second instrument is the interpretation and the study of written sources of the past, so the fencing manuals of the past, which have been, in the last decades, found, studied, translated, and published, and made available to the general public. These written sources are the core of the historical side of historical European martial arts. But there is a third important aspect, and it is the study of historical weapons and fencing gear. I had the luck of being the of studying in a museum. My fencing master, Elena Merlin, is the curator of a fencing museum here in northern Italy. So studying historical samples of fighting sword, but also of fencing swords, helps you understand the evolution of the fencing technique, fencing practice, and fencing context. You can clearly see when a sword is the product of a skilled artisan and an elite product, and when a sword is actually the son of the first or second industrial revolution. It clearly shows, you can see what the mentality or the master was. You can see which aspects of the swordsmanship were emphasized in the practice sword, in the foil of the time. I am a small sword practitioner and teacher, and one aspect of period swords that is to be understood, in my opinion, is the fact that the fighting small swords had triangular blade, the hollow blades, or in Italy more often hexagonal or anyway sharp blades, whereas foils tended to have rectangular blades. We today should understand that the masters all the time preferred to teach with what we would now consider the foil blades. So the study of ancient and old swords is a valuable tool, as well as modern fencing, as well as written sources. These are three aspects of the same discipline.
Thank you, Carlo. I would like to ask you one final question. As I mentioned, we here on this show, tradition, very important. We also finished with a traditional question. Can you tell us maybe about some books which you are reading right now? Maybe something you can tell our readers about, some recommendation?
Yes, I'm reading La Scherma di Spada by Jean-Joseph Renaud, translated by Italo Manusardi. It is a text on the subject of French épée fencing, and I'm also reading The French Revolution, 1789 up to 1799 by Michel Vauvel. This is a purely historical text, and it deals very well with the specific phases of the French Revolution up until the passage to the Napoleonic era. And I'm also reading the catalog of the Stibert Museum, which deals with the side swords that are kept inside the Stibert Museum. And these are the books that are on my desk at the moment. But I have also been reading, of course, philosophical texts, because my job is to teach philosophy. So I can recommend the manual by Epitteto, which is a short text, but very, very interesting. Lately, I've been reading some essays by David Hume, who is always interesting. And as far as history goes, a friend of mine, Cosimo Cerardi, has written The Roots of Scientific Communism, which deals with the origins of the Communist Party and the communist ideology in the 19th century.
Thank you for this answer. It's making me feel that I am not very smart, but that is okay. Very often I have guests here who are smarter than me. This is normal on this show. But I would like to thank you for being here with us, Carlo. And when you finish your next book, which you said you are working on the next book, you are, of course, welcome here again.
Thank you very much, Boris. It has been a pleasure, and you are a real gentleman. You treated me better than my students do, and better than my professors did. You are a real gentleman.
Thank you, Carlo.